Now, from digital movies and TV to electronic books. Online retailer Amazon says it is now selling more electronic books than hardcovers. Even Amazon says it's surprised by how fast things have changed. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
Amazon has been selling hardback books for 15 years. It began selling its Kindle book reader and the e-books to go with it less than 3 years ago. And yet, this past spring and early summer, Amazon sold 143 e-books for every 100 hardcovers. And the gap favoring the electronic versions is widening quickly.
I think the thing that's compelling to most people is it sounds like the beginning of the end.
Joseph Janes, who teaches at the Information School at the University of Washington, calls the shift toward e-books inevitable as we move from an analog to a digital world.
It's going to be a halting but probably steady forward path towards digital versions of what we used to think of as a book. And I think for a lot of people, especially if you can bump up the font size and adjust the lighting, for people who have reading impairments or just old eyes like some of us do, some of these digital readers are a godsend.
Amazon says consumers love the convenience of electronic books. They probably like the price, too. The vast majority of Amazon's e-books cost less than $10. Hardcover books average about $25. What's more, Amazon recently slashed the price of its book reader. Steve Kessel is Amazon's senior executive overseeing the Kindle.
In the last 30 or so days since we've reduced the price, what we've seen is a tripling in the growth of that business, meaning that we've reached a tipping point with the new price of Kindle.
Last month, in response to competitive pressures from Barnes & Noble and more notably from Apple's iPad, Amazon dropped the price of its Kindle from $259 to $189. Analyst Aaron Kessler of a firm called Think Equity says some people initially thought the iPad, which can be used as a book reader but does lots of other things too, would hurt Amazon dearly. But he doesn't see it turning out that way.
To a certain degree, it probably has cannibalized the Kindle device, although we think it's probably accelerated the sale of digital books, which ultimately is where I think Amazon should be making more of the money is on the book side versus the hardware sales.
The total number of books sold by Amazon is rising, and paperbacks remain the most popular. But the online retailer won't say how many books of any type it sells. It won't even say how many Kindle devices have been bought. But based on survey data, analyst James McQuivy of Forrester Research thinks the number of e-book readers is now well into the millions.
There are probably about 6 million of these in the market right now, most of which are Amazon Kindle. Sony and Barnes & Noble make up the biggest portion of the rest of them. By the end of this year, though, we'll be close to 11 million.
And with 11 million e-book readers, a lot more electronic books are likely to be sold. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
This next story is for those of us who find ourselves answering emails on our BlackBerry, even as we chatter away on our iPhones. Those of us who find our right index fingers twitching on the mouse, even as we type, just itching to click on something new every few seconds. It's for those of us, in other words, who without even realizing it, have signed up for a life where we're basically all connected all the time. Now, whether this is a good thing is the subject of William Powers' new book. It's called Hamlet's BlackBerry. And William Powers, early in the book, you describe a scene that rang so true to me. You were standing at a crosswalk in Manhattan. Tell me what happened.
I was standing at a crosswalk, and I looked around me, and there were 5 to 8 people, maybe as many as 10 people, everyone staring into a digital device, basically staring into their palm. And here I was in New York, the most fantastic city in the world, so much to look at, to see and hear, and everybody around me essentially wasn't present.
In this very busy city, but all
yes.
In their own little worlds.
You know, and these gadgets are wonderful and they do fantastic stuff for us all day long, but to miss out on your surroundings all the time, which I think we increasingly do, I really question that.
That's a scene that many of us who live in big cities or travel to big cities can relate to these days. What struck me in your book was that this is actually not a totally new phenomenon, this feeling of being overwhelmed with technology and communication. You don't think, for example, about ancient Rome, Seneca, wandering around being overwhelmed by all the communication demands in your book, you write. Maybe he was.
It's true. You know, in trying to solve this problem, which I call the conundrum of connectedness, this idea that we have these devices, we love them, they do so much for us, and yet they also impose this burden on us and are beginning to pull us away from stuff that really matters. In trying to solve it, I looked to the past to see if there were other times when people faced a similar challenge that we could learn from. And I found there really were. There were quite a number of times whenever a new technology comes along that fills everyday life with new information, people feel a bit overwhelmed and can even become addicted to it. And indeed, the Roman philosopher Seneca felt so burdened by the connectedness of his own time and the crazy kind of pace of life in ancient Rome, he talked about he and his friends suffering from, quote, the restless energy of a hunted mind, the inability to get away from their connected lives, much as we can't seem to get away from our screens.
And in his case, what was it that was so overwhelming?
Well, it was empire. It was the idea of empire, which had pulled everyone together very tightly, and people were living in these cities that were bigger than cities anyone had ever lived in before. There was noise, and there was just busyness. There was more work. There was paperwork. It was papyrus work at the time, but it was paperwork. There was bureaucracy. There was just a lot of incoming. Now, living in the electronic age, we think, God, that incoming must have been so slow and manageable. But to them, as today, it was a new thing. It was a major step up in basically the hecticness of everyday life, and they had trouble managing it.
Flash forward a few centuries, and you have another example I loved. This is Shakespeare's time.
Mm-hmm.
When the printing press was suddenly flooding people with all of this printed material that they hadn't obviously had access to before. And you write about how in his great work, Hamlet, Shakespeare actually gives Hamlet a device to deal with this. Tell us about that.
Yes, there's a point in the play, early in the play, where Hamlet meets the ghost. And the ghost has this terrible news about Hamlet's father having been murdered. And Hamlet is so overwhelmed by this news, this new piece of information, that he's not sure what to do with it. And he talks about how cluttered and distracted his mind is, actually, much like our minds today. And he reaches into his pocket, or the clothing he wears, and he pulls out something he refers to as his tables. And this moment tends to go by in the play when we're watching it because we think of a table like the table we eat breakfast on. But in fact, tables in that time were a new gadget that people used to sort of bring order to their everyday lives. And it was basically an erasable, plaster-like surface inside of a little booklet. You could write notes during the day and then wipe them away clean at night, so that in a sense, the burden of the printed word, which is what the information overload at that time was, could be wiped away. And this new gadget, interestingly, was a way of dealing with overload.
Let me play devil's advocate for
yes.
a moment. Because the flip side here is we all love all this technology. I mean, I love my iPhone. You could not pry it from my cold, dead hands. So what are we to do?
We do. In fact, early in the book, I have a chapter called The Magic of Screens, in which I talk about how amazingly magical they are and the great things they do. I mean, with a few keystrokes, I can bring up an old manuscript from the British Museum. You know, that is miraculous. The trouble is, when so much information is coming at us all day long, we don't have any gaps, any breaks in which to make sense of it, do something new, creative with it, enjoy it, really. And the same with our relationships. If we're constantly toggling between people on Facebook and texts and all these new ways of connecting all day long, and we never have a sustained connection, it's not really connectedness. So my aim in the book is to help people develop new strategies where we're just smarter about this, where we connect more wisely and get more out of it.
I guess the obvious solution is we should just unplug, turn off all these devices. I have a friend, actually, who's trying to write a book, and he's just paid $10 for a software program to block his internet access
yeah.
so he can actually get some writing done. I mean, is this what it's come to?
It has come to that. There are all kinds of emerging answers like that, and they are very much in sync with my message. I think we've only just begun to recognize that connectedness serves us best when it's balanced by a little bit of disconnectedness. And it's all about that. It's basically about having some of A and then some of B, and they actually offset and enrich each other. My family has a ritual where we disconnect on the weekends. We call it the Internet Sabbath.
Disconnect, turn off what?
We turn
all
off
modems,
the household modem.
Okay.
And we don't have smartphones, so therefore we can't get out our inboxes for the whole weekend. We can't do web surfing. We can still call. And it's wonderful. And interestingly, the effects of it, both on our family life, our work lives, everything, carry over into the week. Even when we're connected, we can feel the benefits of having been disconnected a couple days ago. It really helps. It's just about that simple word, balance. But as a lot of people can attest, it's very hard to pull away. You have to know why you're doing it and really believe.
Well, William Powers, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That's William Powers. His new book is Hamlet's Blackberry. And you can read an excerpt from William Powers' new book on our website at npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Thirteen 13,000 geographers, social scientists, and city planners descended on San Diego last week for a conference on digital mapping. They create and use sophisticated mapping technology for all manner of things these days to respond to emergencies, improve mass transit services, chart rates of disease in communities. The children of the conference attendees were also in on the learning experience, as Lisa Napoli reports.
Ballroom D looks like any other windowless ballroom in any other convention hotel, except for the fact that it's tricked out with giant cardboard cutouts of cartoon forests and animals and flat panel computer screens. Welcome to high-tech geography camp.
We're making a map to show where there's suitable pastures
for cattle and sheep
to go and graze and live when there's an emergency.
11-year-old Rosemary Norheim of Seattle is working with her partner through the first assignment, drawing a digital map to show which parts of the San Juan National Forest in Colorado are safe for grazing animals. This software is a version of what her father, an environmental research scientist, uses in his work. Making a digital map, the class leaders say, is like making a sandwich, a layering of pictures and data. Instructor Colin Child says while children grow up today with GPS in the car, they need to learn how those maps get made.
It's our job to try and build the connection between what they use these days together with what they should know about map reading and about the kind of doing analysis and stuff and asking questions.
This is fifth grader Kovid Talam's second year at camp. His favorite aspect of this map-making process is personalizing it.
For me, for most of all, what I like is the legend. You get to change everything on the map. Like, just one color can change the whole map.
After a snack break, Kovid and the other kids are clicking through the prompts on their screens for their next assignment, to reconstruct Mount St. Helens before its eruption. Using 3D mapping technology and a worksheet, they build out the layers of the volcano. Soon, all the computer screens are lighting up bright orange and yellow and green, and everyone's virtually navigating the digital mountain landscape with their mouse.
Ah, so that would be this would be the forest, and that would be the Grand River? Okay, now we can see the actual elevations here. So that would be the lowest is what they're saying. This little strip of yellow over here is the second lowest.
Waiting in the wings for his sons is Jason Duke. He's a geographer with the Fish and Wildlife Service in Tennessee. Here at the conference, he's presented maps he's made using this kind of technology to chart the fate of birds affected by the spill in the Gulf. He said the disaster is the perfect reason for his kids to learn what he does and why maps are so important.
Everything now is so visual. Everything has a map, from MapQuest to Google Maps to all the maps that we're producing with this software for the oil spill. And of course, you can show your children a lot, but they always believe you more, and it comes from someone else.
And maybe they respect you more, too. Here's Duke's 9-year-old son, Carter.
Now I know why he's so tired when he gets home. I'm pretty
sure. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Napoli.
This is NPR.